the fading sunset, the sprouting grass so far below. Tired. She was tired. She couldn't think now. She needed to sleep. Professor Flitwick had told her that she needed to sleep, and there'd been yet another potion with her dinner. Maybe that was how Wizarding Society treated horrible traumas to innocent young girls, just made them sleep a lot afterward. She should go to her room and sleep, but she was afraid to go someplace where other people were. Afraid of how they might look at her, or look away. Fragments of thought chased themselves around a mind too exhausted to finish or connect them as the night fully set in. Why? Why did all this happen? Everything was fine a week ago. Why? From behind her came the creaky sound of an opening door. She turned her head and looked. Professor Quirrell was leaning against the doorway she had walked through, silhouetted like a cardboard cutout by the light of the Hogwarts torches lit behind him in the open door. She couldn't see his expression, though the doorway behind him was bright. His eyes, his face, everything she could see from here lay within night's shadow. The Defense Professor of Hogwarts, number one on the list of people who might have done this. She hadn't even realized she had a suspect list until that moment. The man stood within that doorway, saying nothing, and she couldn't see his eyes. What was he even doing there in the first place?
"Are you here to kill me?"
said Hermione Granger. Professor Quirrell's head tilted at that. Then the defense professor started toward her, the dark silhouette raising one hand slowly and deliberately, as though to push her off the Ravenclaw Tower.
"Stupefy!"
The burst of adrenaline overrode everything. She drew her wand without thinking. Her lips formed the word of their own accord. The stun bolt leapt out of her wand and slowed to a stop in front of Professor Quirrell's raised hand, rippling in midair like it was still trying to fly and making a slight hissing sound. The red glow illuminated Professor Quirrell's face for the first time, showing a strange, fond smile.
"Better," said Professor Quirrell. "Miss Granger, you are still a student in my defense class. As such, if you consider me a threat, I do not expect you to just look at me sadly and ask if I am there to kill you. -2 Quirrell points."
She was entirely unable to form words. The defense professor flicked his forefinger casually at the suspended stun bolt, sending the hex shooting back over her head, far into the night, so that they stood again in darkness. Then, Professor Quirrell walked out of the doorway, which swung shut behind him, and a soft white light sprung up around the two of them so that she could see his face once more, still with that strange, fond smile.
"What are you... what are you doing here?"
A few more steps took Professor Quirrell to a higher part of the balcony's ramparts, where he put his elbows down on the stone, and leaned over heavily, looking up into the night.
"I came here straight upon being released by the Aurors, the moment I finished reporting to the headmaster," said Professor Quirrell in a quiet voice. "Because I am your teacher, and you are my student, and I am responsible for you."
Hermione understood then, remembering what Professor Quirrell had said to Harry in the second defense lesson of the year about controlling his anger. She felt the rush of shame all the way down her chest. It took a moment after that for knowledge to override mortification, for her to force out the words.
"I,"
said Hermione,
"Harry thinks that I didn't lose my temper, I mean."
"So I heard," said Professor Quirrell in rather dry tones. He shook his head as though at the stars themselves. "The boy is fortunate that I have crossed the line from annoyance with his self-destructiveness into sheer curiosity as to what he shall do next. But I agree with Mr. Potter's assessment of the facts. This murder was well planned to evade detection both by the wards of Hogwarts and the headmaster's timely eye. Naturally, in such a thoughtful murder, some innocent would be placed to take the blame."
A brief, wry smile crossed the defense professor's lips, though he wasn't looking at her.
"As for the notion that you did it yourself, I consider myself a talented teacher, but even I could not teach such murderous intent to a student as obstinate and untalented as Hermione Granger."
The part of her brain that said "what" in indignation wasn't anywhere near loud enough to reach her lips.
"No," said Professor Quirrell, "that is not why I am here. You have made no effort to hide your dislike for me, Miss Granger. I thank you for that lack of pretense, for I much prefer true hate to false love. But you are still my student, and I have a word to say to you, if you will hear it."
Hermione looked at him, still fighting down the after-effects of the adrenaline from before. The defense professor seemed to be just staring up at the dark sky in which the stars were becoming visible.
"I was going to be a hero once," said Professor Quirrell, still looking upward. "Can you believe that, Miss Granger?"
"No."
"Thank you again, Miss Granger. It is true, nonetheless. Long ago, long before your time or Harry Potter's, there was a man who was hailed as a savior, the destined scion, such a one as anyone would recognize from tales, wielding justice and vengeance like twin wands against his dreadful nemesis."
Professor Quirrell gave a soft, bitter laugh, looking up at the night sky.
"Do you know, Miss Granger, at that time I thought myself already cynical, and yet, well..."
The silence stretched in the cold and the night.
"In all honesty," said Professor Quirrell, looking up at the stars, "I still don't understand it. They should have known that their lives depended on that man's success, and yet it was as if they tried to do everything they could to make his life unpleasant, to throw every possible obstacle into his way. I was not naive, Miss Granger. I did not expect the power holders to align themselves with me so quickly. Not without something in it for themselves, but their power, too, was threatened. And so I was shocked how they seemed content to step back and leave to that man all burdens of responsibility. They sneered at his performance, remarking among themselves how they would do better in his place, though they did not condescend to step forward.
Professor Quirrell shook his head as though in bemusement. "And it was the strangest thing. The Dark Wizard, that man's dread nemesis. Why, those who served him leapt eagerly to their tasks. The Dark Wizard grew crueler toward his followers, and they followed him all the more. Men fought for the chance to serve him, even as those whose lives depended on that other man made free to render his life difficult. I could not understand it, Miss Granger."
Professor Quirrell's face was in shadow as he looked upward.
"Perhaps by taking on himself the curse of action, that man removed it from all others. Was that why they felt free to hinder his battle against the Dark Wizard, who would have enslaved them all? Believing men would act in their own interest was not cynicism, it turned out, but sheerest optimism. In reality, men do not meet so high a standard. And so in time that one realized he might do better fighting the Dark Wizard alone than with such followers at his back."
"So?"
Hermione's voice sounded strange in the night.
"You left your friends behind where they'd be safe, and tried to attack the Dark Wizard all by yourself?"
"Why, no," said Professor Quirrell. "I stopped trying to be a hero, and went off to do something else I found more pleasant."
"What?"
said Hermione, without thinking at all.
"That's horrible."
The defense professor turned his head down from the sky to regard her, and she saw, in the light of the doorway, that he was smiling. Or at least half his face was smiling.
"Are you going to tell me, Miss Granger, that I am an awful person? Well, perhaps I am. But then, are people who never even try to be heroes still worse? If I had never done anything at all, like them, would you have thought better of me?"
Hermione opened her mouth and then found that, once again, she didn't have anything to say. It wasn't right to walk away from being a hero. You couldn't just do that. But she didn't want to say that everyone who wasn't a hero was nothing. That was Quirrell thinking. The smile, or half-smile, had disappeared.
"You were foolish," the defense professor said quietly, "to expect any lasting gratitude from those you tried to protect once you named yourself a heroine, just as you expected that man to go on being a hero and called him horrible for stopping when 1,000 others never lifted a finger. It was only expected that you should fight bullies. It was a tax you owed, and they accepted it like princes, with a sneer for the lateness of your payment. And you have already witnessed, I wager, that their fondness vanished like dust in the wind once it was no longer in their interest to associate with you."
The defense professor slowly straightened off the balcony, standing almost straight, turning to regard her fully.
"But you don't have to be a hero, Miss Granger," said Professor Quirrell. "You can stop any time you please."
That idea had occurred to her before, several times over the last 2 days.
people become who they are meant to be by doing what is right,"
Headmaster Dumbledore had told her. The trouble was that there seemed to be two different right things to do. There was the part of her which said that right was to go on being a heroine and stay at Hogwarts. She didn't know what was going on, but a heroine wouldn't just run away. And there was also the voice of common sense saying that young children shouldn't ever stay around danger. That was what adults were for. The voice of every school poster that said not to take sweets from strangers. That was also right. Hermione Granger stood there on that balcony, looking at Professor Quirrell silhouetted by the emerging stars, and she didn't understand. She didn't understand how the defense professor could be gazing at her with his face showing concern. She didn't understand the notes of pain in the defense professor's voice that caught at her. She didn't understand why she was being told all this.
"You don't even like me, Professor," said Hermione.
A small smile flickered on Professor Quirrell's face.
"I suppose I could go on about how I am angered that this affair has taken up my valuable time and disrupted my defense classes. But mostly, Miss Granger, you are my student, and whatever other professions I may have once held, I think I have been a good teacher at Hogwarts, have I not?"
Suddenly, Professor Quirrell's eyes seemed very tired.
"As your teacher, then, I am advising you that you have other career options. I should not like to see anyone else going down my path."
Hermione swallowed. It was a side of Professor Quirrell she'd never seen or imagined, and it was eating away at her preconceptions. Professor Quirrell watched her for a moment, and then looked away from her again, back up at the stars. When he spoke this time, his voice was quieter.
"Someone here is targeting you, Miss Granger, and I cannot ward you as I warded Mr. Malfoy. The headmaster has prevented it, for what he claims to be good reasons. It is easy to become fond of Hogwarts. I know, for I am fond of it as well. But in France, they take a different view of the ancient houses than in Britain. And Beauxbatons would not mistreat you, I think. Whatever else you imagine of me, I swear that if you asked me to see you safely in Beauxbatons, I would do all in my power to convey you there."
"I can't just..."
Hermione said.
"But you can, Miss Granger."
Now the pale blue eyes watched her intently.
"Whatever you wish to make of your life, you cannot attain it at Hogwarts. Not anymore. This place is ruined for you now, even leaving aside all other threats. Simply ask Harry Potter to command you to go to Beauxbatons and live out your life in peace. If you stay here, he is your master in the eyes of Britain and its laws."
She hadn't even been thinking about that. It paled so much in comparison to being eaten by Dementors. It had been important to her before, but now it all seemed childish, unimportant, pointless. So why were her eyes burning?
"And if that fails to move you, Miss Granger, consider also that Mr. Potter has, just today at lunchtime, threatened Lucius Malfoy, Albus Dumbledore, and the entire Wizengamot because he cannot think sensibly when something threatens to take you from him. Are you not frightened of what he will do next?"
It made sense. Terrible sense. Dreadful, awful sense. It made too much sense. She couldn't have described it in words, what triggered the realization, unless it was the sheer pressure that the defense professor was exerting on her. That if the defense professor was behind this whole thing, then Professor Quirrell had done it all just to get her out of the way of his plans for Harry. Without any conscious decision, she shifted her weight to the other foot, her body moving away from the defense professor.
"So, you think I am the one responsible?" said Professor Quirrell.
His voice sounded a little sad as he said it, and her own heart almost stopped from hearing it.
"I suppose I cannot blame you. I am the defense professor of Hogwarts, after all. But, Miss Granger, even assuming that I am your enemy, common sense should still tell you to get away from me very quickly. You cannot use the killing curse, so the correct tactic is to apparate away. I do not mind being the villain of your imagination if it makes matters clearer. Leave Hogwarts, and leave me to those who can handle me. I will arrange for the transportation to be through some family of good repute, and Mr. Potter will know to blame me if you do not arrive safely."
She was feeling cold, the night air chilling her skin, or maybe being chilled by it.
"I've got to think about it."
Professor Quirrell shook his head.
"No, Miss Granger, your departure will take time for me to arrange, and I have less time left than you may think. This decision may be painful for you, but it should not be ambiguous. Much weighs in the balance of these scales, but not evenly. I must know tonight whether you intend to go."
And if not? Was the professor warning her deliberately that if she didn't run, he would strike again? Why would it matter so much? What did Professor Quirrell want to do with Harry?
"Hermione Granger, I shall be less subtle than is usual for a mysterious old wizard, and tell you outright that you cannot imagine how badly things could go if the events surrounding Harry Potter turn to ill."
The most powerful wizard in the world had told her that, when he was talking about how important it was that she not stop being Harry's friend. Hermione swallowed. She swayed a little where she stood, on the stone balcony of a magical castle. Suddenly, the whole deadly absurdity of the situation seemed to rise up and grab her by the throat. That 12-year-old girls shouldn't be in danger, shouldn't be thinking about such things. That Mum would want her to run away, and her father would have a heart attack if he even knew she was being faced with the question. And she knew then, as Harry and Dumbledore had both tried to warn her, that everything she'd ever thought about being a heroine had been mistaken. That there wasn't really any such things as heroes, outside of stories. There was just horrible danger, and being arrested by auras, and put in cells next to Dementors. Pain, and fear, and...
"Miss Granger," said the defense professor. She said nothing. All the words were blocked in her throat. "I need a decision, Miss Granger."
She kept her jaw locked, didn't let any words come out. Finally, the defense professor sighed. Slowly, the white light failed, and slowly the door behind him swung open, so that he was once again a black silhouette against the opening.
"Good night, Miss Granger," he said, and turned his back to her, and walked away into Hogwarts.
It took a while for her breathing to slow down again. Whatever had happened here tonight, it didn't feel anything like victory. She had fought so hard just to stop herself from saying yes in the face of the defense professor's pressure, and now she didn't even know if she'd done the right thing. When she walked back into the light herself, after exhaustion had overtaken everything and sleep was once more a possibility, she thought she heard it as she was within the doorway. From behind her and above her, a distant, cawing cry. But it wasn't meant for her, she knew, so she climbed up the stairs toward her dorm room. The other girls were probably asleep by now, and wouldn't look at her, or look away. She felt the tears start, and this time she didn't stop them.
Chapter 85. Taboo Trade-Offs, Aftermath 3. Distance. Slow and hard, the long stairway that led to the peak of Ravenclaw. From the inside, the stairway seemed like a straight upward slope, though from the outside you could see that it logically had to be a spiral. You could only get to the top of the Ravenclaw Tower by making that long climb without shortcuts, stone step by stone step, passing beneath Harry's shoes, pushed down by his wearying legs. Harry had seen Hermione safely off to bed. He had lingered in the Ravenclaw common room long enough to collect a few signatures that might be useful to Hermione later. Not many students had signed. Wizards hadn't been trained to think in the put up or shut up, stick your neck out and make a prediction, or stop pretending to believe in your theory rules of Muggle science. Most of them hadn't seen anything incongruent about being too nervous to sign an agreement saying that Hermione got to hold it over them for the rest of their lives if they were wrong, while acting outwardly confident that she was guilty. But just having demanded the signatures would make the point after the truth came out, if anyone ever again suspected Hermione of anything dark. She wouldn't have to go through this twice, at least. After that, Harry had left the common room quickly, because all the kindly, forgiving sentiments he'd reasoned out were getting harder and harder to remember. Sometimes Harry thought the deepest split in his personality wasn't anything to do with his dark side. Rather, it was the divide between the altruistic and forgiving, abstract reasoning Harry versus the frustrated and angry Harry in the moment. The circular platform at the top of the Ravenclaw Tower wasn't the tallest place in Hogwarts, but the Ravenclaw Tower jutted out from the main body of the castle, so you couldn't see down into the top platform from the Astronomy Tower. A quiet place to think, if you had an awful lot to think about. A place where few other students ever came. There were easier niches of privacy, if privacy was all you wanted. The night-lit torches of Hogwarts were far below. The platform itself offered few obstructions. The stairs emerged from an uncovered gap in the floor rather than an upright door. From this place, then, the stars were as visible as they ever were on Earth. The boy lay down in the center of the platform, heedless of his robes that might be dirtied, dropping his head to rest upon the rock-tiled floor, so that, except for a few half-seen crenellations of stone at Vision's Edge, and a sliver of crescent moon, reality became starlight. The pinpoints of light in dark velvet twinkled, wavering and returning, a different kind of beauty from their steady brilliance in the silent night. Harry gazed out abstractly, his mind on other things.
"This day, your war against Voldemort has begun."
Dumbledore had said that after the incident with rescuing Bellatrix from Azkaban. That had been a false alarm, but the phrase expressed the sentiment well. 2 nights ago, his war had begun, and Harry didn't know with who. Dumbledore thought it was Lord Voldemort, returned from the dead, making his first move against the boy who had defeated him last time. Professor Quirrell had put detection wards on Draco, fearing that Hogwarts's mad headmaster would try to frame Harry for the death of Lucius's son. Or Professor Quirrell had set up the entire thing, and that was how he'd known where to find Draco. Severus Snape thought the Hogwarts defense professor was an obvious subject, even the obvious suspect. And Severus Snape himself might, or might not be, even remotely trustworthy. Someone had declared war against Harry. Their first strike had been meant to take out Draco and Hermione both, and it was only by the barest of margins that Harry had saved Hermione. You couldn't call it a victory. Draco had been removed from Hogwarts, and if that wasn't death, it wasn't clear how it could be undone, or what shape Draco might be in when he got back. The country of magical Britain now thought Hermione an attempted murderer, which might or might not make her decide to do the same thing and leave. Harry had sacrificed his entire fortune to undo his loss, and that card could only be played once. Some unknown power had struck at him, and if that blow had been partially deflected, it had still hit really hard. At least his dark side hadn't asked anything of him in exchange for saving Hermione. Maybe because his dark side wasn't an imaginary voice like Hufflepuff, Harry might imagine his Hufflepuff part as wanting different things from himself, but his dark side wasn't like that. His dark side, so far as Harry could tell, was a different way that Harry sometimes was. Right now, Harry wasn't angry, and trying to ask what Dark Harry wanted was a phone ringing unanswered. The thought even seemed a little strange. Could you owe something to a different way you sometimes were? Harry stared up at the random stars, the scattered twinkling lights that human brains couldn't help but pattern match into imaginary constellations. And then there was that promise Harry had sworn. Draco, to help Harry reform Slytherin House, and Harry had to take as an enemy whomever Harry believed, in his best judgment as a rationalist, to have killed Narcissa Malfoy. If Narcissa had never gotten her own hands dirty, if indeed she'd been burned alive, if the killer hadn't been tricked, those were all the conditions Harry could remember making. He probably should have written it down, or better yet, never made a promise requiring that many caveats in the first place. There were plausible outs, for the sort of person who'd let themselves rationalize an out. Dumbledore hadn't actually confessed. He hadn't come right out and said he had done it. There were plausible reasons for an actually guilty Dumbledore to behave that way. but it was also what you'd expect to see if someone else had burned Narcissa and Dumbledore had taken credit. Harry shook his head, flattening one side of his hair and then another against the stone-tiled floor. There was still a final out. Draco could still release him from the oath at any time. He could, at least, describe the situation to Draco and talk about options with him when they met again. It didn't seem like a very likely prospect for release, but the idea of talking something over honestly was enough to satisfy the part of himself that demanded adherence to oaths, even if it only meant delaying. It was better than taking a good man as an enemy.
"But is Dumbledore a good man?" asked the voice of Hufflepuff. "If Dumbledore burned someone alive, wasn't the whole point that good people may kill, but never kill with suffering?" "Maybe he killed her instantly," said Slytherin, "and then lied to Lucius about the burning alive part. But if there was any possibility of the Death Eaters magically verifying how Narcissa died, and if being caught in a lie would have endangered Lightside families, be careful what we cleverly rationalize," warned Gryffindor. "You have to expect reputational effects on how other people treat you," said Hufflepuff. "If you decide there's sufficient reason to burn a woman alive, one of the predictable side effects is that good people decide you've crossed the line and have to be stopped. Dumbledore should have expected that. He's got no right to complain. Or maybe he expects us to be smarter," said Slytherin. "Now that we know this much of the truth, no matter the exact details of the full story, can we really believe that Dumbledore is a terrible, terrible person who ought to be our enemy? In the middle of a horribly bloody war, Dumbledore set one enemy civilian on fire. That's only bad by the standards of comic books, not by any sort of realistic historical standard."
Harry stared up at the night sky, remembering history. In real life, in real wars, during World War II, there had been a project to sabotage the Nazi nuclear weapons program. Years earlier, Leo Szilard, the first person to realize the possibility of a fission chain reaction, had convinced Fermi not to publish the discovery that purified graphite was a cheap and effective neutron moderator. Fermi had wanted to publish, for the sake of the great international project of science, which was above nationalism. But Szilard had persuaded Rabi, and Fermi had abided by the majority vote of their tiny three-person conspiracy. And so, years later, the only neutron moderator the Nazis had known about was deuterium. The only deuterium source under Nazi control had been a captured facility in occupied Norway, which had been knocked out by bombs and sabotaged, causing a total of 24 civilian deaths. The Nazis had tried to ship the deuterium already refined to Germany aboard a civilian Norwegian ferry, the SS Hydro. Knut Hochlid and his assistants had been discovered by the night watchman of the civilian ferry while they were sneaking on board to sabotage it. Hochlid had told the watchman that they were escaping the Gestapo, and the watchman had let them go. Hochlid had considered warning the night watchman, but that would have endangered the mission, so Hochlid had only shaken his hand. And the civilian ship had sunk in the deepest part of the lake, with 8 dead Germans, 7 dead crew, and 3 dead civilian bystanders. Some of the Norwegian rescuers of the ship had thought the German soldiers present should be left to drown,
but this view had not prevailed, and the German survivors had been rescued. And that had been the end of the Nazi nuclear weapons program. Which was to say that Knut Hochlid had killed innocent people. One of whom, the night watchman of the ship, had been a good person. Someone who'd gone out of his way to help Hochlid at risk to himself, from the kindness of his heart, for the highest moral reasons, and been sent to drown in turn. Afterward, in the cold light of history, it had looked like the Nazis had never been close to getting nuclear weapons after all. And Harry had never read anything suggesting that Hochlid had acted wrongly. That was war in real life. In terms of total damage and who'd gotten hit, what Hochlid had done was considerably worse than what Dumbledore might have done to Narcissa Malfoy, or what Dumbledore had possibly done to leak the prophecy to Lord Voldemort to get him to attack Harry's parents. If Hochlid had been a comic book superhero, he'd have somehow gotten all the civilians off the ferry. He would have attacked the German soldiers directly, rather than let a single innocent person die. But Knut Hochlid hadn't been a superhero. And neither had been Albus Dumbledore. Harry closed his eyes, swallowing hard a few times against the sudden choking sensation. It was abruptly very clear that while Harry was going around trying to live the ideals of the Enlightenment, Dumbledore was the one who actually fought in a war. Non-violent ideals were cheap to hold if you were a scientist living inside the Protego bubble cast by the police officers and soldiers whose actions you had the luxury to question. Albus Dumbledore seemed to have started out with ideals at least as strong as Harry's own, if not stronger. And Dumbledore hadn't gotten through his war without killing enemies and sacrificing friends.
"Are you so much better than Hawklid and Dumbledore, Harry Potter, that you'll be able to fight without a single casualty, even in the world of comic books? The only reason a superhero like Batman even looks successful is that the comic book readers only notice when important named characters die, not when the Joker shoots some random, nameless bystander to show off his villainy. Batman is a murderer, no less than the Joker, for all the lives the Joker took that Batman could have saved by killing him. That's what the man named Alistair was trying to tell Dumbledore. And afterward, Dumbledore regretted having taken so long to change his mind. Are you really going to try to follow the path of the superhero and never sacrifice a single piece or kill a single enemy?"
Fatigued, Harry turned his attention away from the dilemma for a moment, opened his eyes again to regard the hemisphere of night, which required no decisions from him. Near the edge of his vision, the pale white crescent of the moon, the light from which had left 1.25 seconds ago, around 375,000 kilometers of distance in Earth's space of simultaneity. Above and to the side, Polaris, the North Star, the first star Harry had learnt to identify in the sky by following the edge of the Big Dipper. That was actually a 5-star system with a brilliant central supergiant, 434 light-years from Earth. It was the first star whose name Harry had ever learned from his father, so long ago that he couldn't have guessed how old he had been. The dim fog that was the Milky Way, so many billions of stars that they became an indistinct river, the plane of a galaxy that stretched 100,000 light-years across. If Harry had experienced any sense of wonder when he'd first been told that, He'd been too young for him to remember now that first time, across a few years' distance. In the centre of the constellation Andromeda, the star Andromeda, which was really the Andromeda Galaxy, the nearest galaxy to the Milky Way, 2.4 million light-years away, containing an estimated trillion stars. Numbers like those made infinity pale by comparison, because infinity was just featureless and blank. Thinking that the stars were infinitely distant was a lot less scary than trying to work out what 2.4 million light-years amounted to in meters. 2.4 million light-years times 31 million seconds in a year times a photon moving at 300 million meters per second. It was strange to think that such distances might not be unreachably far away. Magic was loose in the universe. Things like time-turners and broomsticks. Had any wizards ever tried to measure the speed of a portkey or a phoenix? And the human understanding of magic couldn't possibly be anywhere near the underlying laws. What would you be able to do with magic if you really understood it? A year ago, Dad had gone to the Australian National University in Canberra for a conference where he'd been an invited speaker, and he'd taken Mum and Harry along. And they'd all visited the National Museum of Australia because, it turned out, there was basically nothing else to do in Canberra. The glass display cases had shown rock throwers crafted by the Australian Aborigines, like giant wooden shoehorns that looked, but smoothed and carved and ornamented with painstaking care. In the 40,000 years since anatomically modern humans had migrated to Australia from Asia, nobody had invented the bow and arrow. It really made you appreciate how non-obvious was the idea of progress. Why would you even think of inventing as something important if all your history's heroic tales were of great warriors and defenders instead of Thomas Edison? How could anyone have suspected, while carving a rock thrower with painstaking care, that someday human beings would invent rocket ships and nuclear energy? Could you have looked up into the sky, at the brilliant light of the sun, and deduced that the universe contained greater sources of power than mere fire? Would you have realized that if the fundamental physical laws permitted it, someday humans would tap the same energies as the sun? Even if nothing you could imagine doing with rock throwers or woven pouches, no pattern of running across the savannah and nothing you could obtain by hunting animals would accomplish that, even in imagination? It wasn't like modern-day muggles had gotten anywhere near the limits of what muggle physics said was possible. And yet, like hunter-gatherers conceptually bound to their rock throwers, most muggles lived in a world defined by the limits of what you could do with cars and telephones. Even though muggle physics explicitly permitted possibilities like molecular nanotechnology or the Penrose process for extracting energy from black holes, most people filed that away in the same section of their brain that stored fairy tales and history books, well away from their personal realities. Long ago and far away. Ever so long ago. No surprise, then, that the wizarding world lived in a conceptual universe bounded, not by fundamental laws of magic that nobody even knew, but just by the surface rules of known charms and enchantments. You couldn't observe the way magic was practiced nowadays and not be reminded of the National Museum of Australia, once you realized what you were seeing. Even if Harry's first guess had been mistaken,
One way or another, it was still inconceivable that the fundamental laws of the universe contained a special case for human lips shaping the phrase Wingardium Leviosa. And yet, even that fumbling grasp of magic was enough to do things that Muggle physics said should be forever impossible. The Time Turner. Water conjured out of nothingness by Aguamenti. What were the ultimate possibilities of invention if the underlying laws of the universe permitted an 11-year-old with a stick to violate almost every constraint in the Muggle version of physics? Like a hunter-gatherer trying to look up at the sun and guess that the universe had to be shaped in a way that allowed for nuclear energy. It made you wonder if maybe 20,000 million meters wasn't so much distance after all. There was a step beyond abstract reasoning, Harry, which he could take, given time enough to compose himself and the right surroundings. Something beyond abstract reasoning, Harry, as that was beyond Harry in the moment. Looking up at the stars, you could try to imagine that the distant descendants of humanity would think of your dilemma. In 100 million years, when the stars would have spun through great galactic movements into entirely new positions, every constellation scattered. It was an elementary theorem of probability that if you knew what your answer would be after updating on future evidence, you ought to adopt that answer right now. If you knew your destination, you were already there. And by analogy, if not quite by theorem, if you could guess what the descendants of humanity would think of something, you ought to go ahead and take that as your own best guess. From that vantage point, the idea of killing off 2/3 of the Wizengamot seemed a lot less appealing than it had a few hours earlier. Even if you had to do it, even if you knew for a solid fact that it would be the best thing for magical Britain, and that the complete story of time would look worse if you didn't do it, even as a necessity, the deaths of sentient beings would still be a tragedy. One more element of the sorrows of Earth, the most ancient Earth from which everything had begun, long ago and far away, ever so long ago.
"He is not like Grindelwald. There is nothing human left in him. Him you must destroy. Save your fury for that, and that alone."
Harry shook his head slightly, tilting the stars a little in his vision as he lay on the stone floor looking upward and outward and forward in time. Even if Dumbledore was right, and the true enemy was utterly mad and evil, in 100 million years the organic life form known as Lord Voldemort probably wouldn't seem much different from all the other bewildered children of ancient Earth. Whatever Lord Voldemort had done to himself, whatever dark ritual seemed so horribly irrevocable on a mere human scale, it wouldn't be beyond curing with the technology of 100 million years. Killing him, even if you had to do it to save the lives of others, would be just one more death for future sentient beings to be sad about. How could you look up at the stars and believe anything else? Harry stared up at the twinkling lights of eternity and wondered what the children's children's children would think of what Dumbledore had maybe done to Narcissa. But even if you tried framing the question that way, asking what humanity's descendants would think, it still drew only on your own knowledge, not theirs. The answer still came from inside yourself, and it could still be mistaken. If you didn't know the 100th decimal digit of pi yourself, then you didn't know how the children's children's children would calculate it, for all that the fact was trivial. Slowly, he'd been lying there, looking at the stars for longer than he'd planned. Harry sat up from the ground, pushing himself to his feet, the muscles protesting. He walked over to the edge of the stone platform at the height of the Ravenclaw Tower. The stone crenellations surrounding the edge of the tower weren't high, not high enough to be safe. They were markers, clearly, rather than railings. Harry didn't approach too close to the edge. There was no point in taking chances. Looking down at the Hogwarts grounds below, he was predictably feeling a sense of dizziness, the wobbly affliction called vertigo. His brain was alarmed, it seemed, because the ground below was so distant. It might have been fully 50 meters away. The lesson, it seemed, was that things had to be incredibly close by before your brain could comprehend them well enough to feel fear. It was a rare brain that could feel strongly about anything if it wasn't close in space, close in time, near at hand, within easy reach. Before, Harry had imagined that going to Azkaban would require planning and cooperation from a grown-up confederate. Portkeys, broomsticks, invisibility spells, some way of getting to the bottom levels without the Aurors noticing, so he could carve his way into the central pit where the shadows of death waited. And that had been enough to put the prospect away, into the future, safely apart from the now. He hadn't realized until today that it might be as simple as finding Forks and telling the Phoenix that it was time. Memories were rising up again. Memories that Harry could never manage to forget for long. Though the stones beneath his feet were not smooth like metal, though the moonlit sky stretched all around him, somehow it was very easy to imagine himself trapped in a long metal corridor lit by dim orange light. The night was quiet. Quiet enough for memories to be clearly audible.
"No, I didn't mean it. Please don't die. No, I didn't mean it. Please don't die. Don't take it away. Don't.
The world blurred, and Harry wiped his eyes with his sleeve. If Hermione had been the one behind that door, if Hermione had been put in Azkaban, Harry would have called the Phoenix and gone there and burned away every last Dementor, and it wouldn't have made a single difference how crazy it was or what else he'd wanted to do with his life. That was just how it was. And the woman who was behind that door, wasn't there someone, somewhere, to whom she too was precious? Wasn't it only Harry's distance from her life that was preventing his brain from being driven to Azkaban to save her, no matter what? What would it have taken to compel him? Would he have needed to know her face, her name, her favourite colour? Would he have been driven to Azkaban to save Tracy Davis? Would he have been compelled there to save Professor McGonagall? Mum and Dad? There wasn't even any question. And that woman had said she was someone's mother. How many people had wished for the power to break Azkaban? How many prisoners of Azkaban dreamed nightly of such a miraculous rescue?
None. It's a happy thought.
Maybe he should harrow Azkaban. All he had to do was find Fawkes and tell him it was time. Visualize the center of the Dementor's pit as he'd seen it from the broomstick, and let the phoenix take him there. Cast the true Patronus charm at point-blank range, and to hell with what came after. All he had to do was go find Fawkes. It might be as simple as thinking of the flame, calling for the firebird in his heart. A star flashed in the night. By the time Harry's eyes had jumped with a reflex action trained on meteor showers, another part of him was surprised that the astronomical phenomenon was still there. A faint star whose brightness was slowly, visibly waxing. There was a startled moment when Harry wondered whether he was seeing not a meteor, but a nova or supernova. Could you see them getting brighter like that? Was the first stage of a nova supposed to be that yellow-orange colour? Then, the new star moved again, and seemed to grow as well as brightening. It looked closer, suddenly, no longer so far away that distance became moot. Like what you thought was a star turned out to be an aeroplane, a lighted form whose shape you could actually see. No, not a plane. The realization seemed to spread out from Harry's chest in a wave of prickling, sweat preparing to break out. A bird. A piercing cry split the night, echoing from the rooftops of Hogwarts. The approaching creature trailed fire as it flew, shedding golden flames like sparks from its feathers as the mighty wings beat and beat again. Even as it swooped up in a great curve to hover a few paces away from Harry, even as the flames surrounding its passage diminished, the creature seemed no dimmer, no less bright, as though some unseen sun shone upon it and illuminated it. Great shining wings, red like a sunset, and eyes like incandescent pearls, blazing with golden fire and determination. The phoenix's beak opened and let out a great caw that Harry understood as though it had been spoken word.
Come!
Not even realizing, the boy stumbled back from the edge of the rooftop, eyes still locked on the phoenix, his whole body trembling and tensed, his fists clutching and releasing at his side, stepping back, stepping away. The phoenix cawed again, a desperate, pleading sound. It didn't come through in words this time, but it came through in feelings, an echo of everything that Harry had ever felt about Azkaban and every temptation to action, to just do something about it. The desperate need to do something now and not delay any longer. All spoken in the cry of a bird.
Let's go. It's time.
The voice that spoke came from inside Harry, not from the phoenix, from so deep inside it couldn't be given a separate name like Gryffindor. All he had to do was step forward and touched the phoenix's talons, and it would take him where he needed to be, where he kept thinking he ought to be, down into the central pit of Azkaban. Harry could see the image in his mind, shining with unbearable clarity, the image of himself suddenly smiling with joyous release as he threw all his fears away and chose.
But I...
Harry whispered, not even aware of what he was saying.
Harry lifted his shaking hands to wipe at his eyes from which tears had sprung, as the phoenix hovered before him with great wing sweeps.
But I... there's other people I also have to save. Other things I have to do.
The Firebird let out a piercing scream, and the boy flinched back as though from a blow. It wasn't a command. It wasn't an objection. It was the knowledge. The corridors, lit by dim orange light. It felt like tightening compulsion in Harry's chest, the desire to just do it and get it over with. He might die, but if he didn't die, he could feel clean again. Have principles that were more than excuses for inaction. It was his life, his to spend, if he chose. He could do it any time he wanted, if he wasn't a good person. The boy stood there on the rooftop, his own eyes locked with two points of fire. The stars might have had time to shift in their constellations while he stood there, agonizing over the decision that wouldn't change. The boy's eyes flickered once to the stars above, and then he looked at the phoenix.
"Not yet,"
the boy said in a voice hardly audible.
"Not yet. There's too much else I have to do. Please, come back later, when I found others who can cast the true Patronus. In 6 months, maybe."
Without word, without sound, a sphere of fire surrounded the bird's form, crackling and blazing with white and crimson veins as though it meant to consume that which lay within. And when the fire disappeared into grey smoke, no phoenix remained. There was silence on the top of the Ravenclaw Tower. The boy gradually lowered his hands from his ears, pausing only to wipe his wet cheeks. Slowly, the boy turned, then cried out and leapt back and almost fell off the Ravenclaw Tower, though the misstep would hardly have mattered with that other wizard standing there.
"And so it was done,"
Albus Dumbledore said, almost in a whisper.
"So it was done."
Fawkes was on his shoulder, staring at where the other phoenix had been with an indecipherable avian gaze.
"What are you doing here?"
"Ah,"
said the ancient man standing on the roof platform's opposite corner.
"I felt the presence of a creature Hogwarts did not know, and came to see, of course."
Slowly, the old wizard's shaking hand came up to remove the half-moon glasses. His other hand wiped at his eyes and forehead with his robe sleeve.
I dared not speak. I knew this choice above all choices must be your own."
A strange apprehension was beginning to fill Harry, welling up in him like a sick feeling in his stomach.
"That everything depended on this,"
Albus Dumbledore said, still in that almost whisper.
"That much I knew. But which choice led into darkness? That I could not guess. At least the choice was your own."
I don't,"
Harry said, and then his voice stopped. A terrible hypothesis, rising in credibility.
"The phoenix comes," said the old wizard, "to those who would fight, to those who would act, even at the cost of their lives, the phoenix comes. Phoenixes are not wise, Harry. They know no means to judge us, save witnessing the choice. I thought it was to my death I went when the phoenix took me to fight Grindelwald. I did not know that forks would sustain me, and heal me, and stay by my side."
The old wizard's voice quavered for a moment.
"It is not spoken of, you should realize, Harry. Why, it is never spoken of. If one knew, the phoenix could not judge. But to you, Harry, I may say it now, for the phoenix comes only once."
The old wizard walked across the top of the Ravenclaw Tower to where a boy stood rooted in dawning horror. In dawning and utter horror.
"In my duel with Grindelwald, I could not win. Only fight him for long hours until he collapsed in exhaustion. And I would have died of it afterward, if not for Fawkes."
Harry didn't even know he was speaking until the whisper had escaped him.
"Then I could have..."
"Could you have?"
said the ancient wizard, his voice sounding far older than his normal tones.
"Three times now, a phoenix has come for my student. One did send hers away, and the grief of it broke her, I think. And the last was cousin to your young friend Lavender Brown, and he..."
The old wizard's voice cracked.
"He did not return, did poor John? And he saved none of those he meant to save. It is said, among the few scholars of Phoenix lore, that not one in four returns from their ordeal. And even if you did survive, for the life you must lead, Harry, James, Potter, Evans, Barris, the choices you must make, and the path you must walk, to always hear the phoenix's cries, who is to say it would not have driven you mad?"
The old wizard raised his sleeve again, drawing it once more across his face.
"I had more joy of Fawkes's companionship in the days before I fought Voldemort."
The boy didn't seem to be listening. All his eyes were on the red gold bird on the ancient wizard's shoulder.
"Fawkes,"
the boy said in a shaking voice.
"Why won't you look at me? Fawkes!"
Fawkes craned his head to peer at the boy curiously, then turned back and resumed gazing at his master.
"See," said the old wizard. "He does not reject you. Fawkes may not be interested in you quite that way now, and he knows,"
the wizard smiled wryly,
"that you are not exactly loyal to his master. But one to whom the phoenix comes at all cannot be one whom a phoenix would dislike."
The wizard's voice fell to a whisper again.
"There never was a bird seen on Godric Gryffindor's shoulder, though it is not written even in his secrets. I think he must have sent his phoenix away before he chose the red and gold for his colours. Perhaps the guilt of it urged him to greater lengths than he ever would have dared otherwise. Or it might have taught him humility and respect for human fragility and failure.
The wizard bowed his head.
I truly do not know if your choice was wise. I truly do not know if it was the right thing or the wrong thing. If I knew, Harry, I would have spoken. But I...
Dumbledore's voice broke then.
I am nothing but a foolish young boy who has become a foolish old man, and I have no wisdom.
Harry couldn't breathe. The nausea seemed to fill and overflow his whole body, stomach locked solid. He was suddenly and terribly certain that he had failed. In some final sense, failed. Failed this very night. The boy whirled and ran out the curb of the Ravenclaw rooftop.
Come back!
His voice cracked, rising to a shriek.
Come back!
Final aftermath.
She came awake with a gasp of horror. She woke with an unvoiced scream on her lips, and no words came forth. She could not understand what she had seen. Could not understand what she had seen.
What time is it?
She whispered. Her golden jeweled alarm clock whispered back.
Around 11 at night. Go back to sleep.
Her sheets were soaked in sweat. Her night clothes soaked in sweat. She took her wand from beside the pillow and cleaned herself up before she tried to go back to sleep, and eventually succeeded. Sybil Trelawney went back to sleep. In the Forbidden Forest, a centaur, woken by a nameless apprehension, ceased scanning the night sky. Having found only questions there and no answers, and with a folding of his many legs, Ferenczi went back to sleep. In the distant lands of magical Asia, an ancient witch named Fantong, sleeping the tired days away, told her anxious great-great-grandson that she was fine. It had only been a nightmare, and went back to sleep. In a land where Muggleborns received no letters of any kind, a girl child too young to have a name of her own was rocked in the arms of her annoyed but loving mother, until she stopped crying and went back to sleep. None of them slept well. Chapter 86. Multiple Hypotheses Testing. International News Headlines of April 7th, 1992. Toronto Magical Tribune.
Entire British Wizengamot report seeing boy who lived frighten a Dementor. Expert on magical creatures. Now you're just lying. France, Germany, accuse Britain of making the whole thing up.
New Zealand spellcrafters' diurnal notice.
What drove British legislator insane? Could our government be next? Experts list top 28 reasons to believe it's already happened.
American Mage.
Werewolf clan to become first inhabitants of Wyoming.
The Quibbler.
Malfoy flees Hogwarts as Veela powers awaken.
Daily Prophet.
Legal tricks free mad muggle born as Potter threatens ministry with attack on Azkaban.
Hypothesis. Voldemort. April 8th, 1992, 7:22 p.m. The four of them gathered once more around the ancient desk of the headmaster of Hogwarts, with its drawers within drawers within drawers, wherein all the past paperwork of the Hogwarts school was stored. Legend had it that Headmistress Sheila had once gotten lost in that desk, and was, in fact, still there, and wouldn't be let out again until she got her files organized. Minerva didn't particularly look forward to inheriting those drawers, when she inherited that desk someday, if any of them survived. Albus Dumbledore was seated behind his desk, looking grave and composed. Severus Snape was standing next to the dead flue and its ashes, hovering ominously like the vampire that students sometimes accused him of pretending to be. Mad-Eye Moody had been meant to join them, but was yet to arrive, and Harry. A boy's small, thin frame, perched on the arm of his chair, as though the energies running through him were too great to allow ordinary seating. Set face, sweaty hair, intent green eyes, and within it all, the jagged lightning bolt of his never-healing scar. He seemed grimmer now, even compared to a single week earlier. For a moment, Minerva flashed back to her trip to Diagon Alley with Harry, what seemed like ages and ages ago. There had been this somber boy inside that Harry, somehow, even then. This wasn't entirely her own fault, or Albus's fault. And yet, there was something almost unbearably sad about the contrast between the young boy she had first met and what magical Britain had made of him. Harry had never had much of an ordinary childhood, she'd gathered. Harry's adoptive parents had said to her that he'd spoken little and played less with Muggle children. It was painful to think that Harry might have had only a few months of playing beside the other children in Hogwarts, before the war's demands had stripped it all away. Maybe there was another face that Harry showed to the children his own age, when he wasn't staring down the Wizengamot. But she couldn't stop herself from imagining Harry Potter's childhood as a heap of firewood, and herself and Albus feeding the wooden branches, piece by piece, into the flames.
"Prophecies are strange things," said Albus Dumbledore.
The old wizard's eyes were half-lidded, as though in weariness.
"Vague, unclear, meaning escaping like water held between loose fingers. Prophecy is ever a burden, for there are no answers there, only questions."
Harry Potter was sitting tensely.
"Headmaster Dumbledore," said the boy with soft precision, "my friends are being targeted. Hermione Granger almost went to Azkaban. The war has begun, as you put it. Professor Trelawney's prophecy is key information for weighing up the balance of my hypothesis about what's going on, not to mention how silly it is, and dangerous, that the Dark Lord knows the prophecy and I don't."
Albus looked a grim question at her, and she shook her head in reply. In whatever unimaginable way Harry had discovered that Trelawney had made the prophecy, and that the Dark Lord knew of it, he hadn't learned that much from her.
"Voldemort, seeking to avert that very prophecy, went to his defeat at your hands,"
the old wizard said then.
"His knowledge brought him only harm. Ponder that carefully, Harry Potter."
Yes, Headmaster, I do understand that. My home culture also has a literary tradition of self-fulfilling and misinterpreted prophecies. I'll interpret with caution, rest assured. But I've already guessed quite a bit. Is it safer for me to work from partial guesses?
Time passed.
Minerva, said Albus, if you would.
The one,
she began. The words came falteringly to her throat. She was no actress. She couldn't imitate the deep, chilling tone of the original prophecy, and yet somehow that tone seemed to carry all the meaning.
The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches, born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month dies.
And the Dark Lord shall mark him as his equal,
came Severus's voice, making her jump within her chair. The potions master loomed tall by the fireplace.
But he shall have power the Dark Lord knows not, and either must destroy all but a remnant of the other. For those two different spirits cannot exist in the same world.
That last line Severus spoke with so much foreboding that it chilled her bones. It was almost like listening to Sybil Trelawney. Harry was listening with a frown.
Can you repeat that?
Said Harry.
The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches, born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month.
Actually, hold on. Can you write that down? I need to analyze this carefully.
This was done, with both Albus and Severus watching the parchment hawk-like, as though to make sure that no unseen hand reached in and snatched the precious information away.
Let's see, Harry said. I'm male, and born on July 31st. Check. I did, in fact, vanquish the Dark Lord. Check. Ambiguous pronoun in line 2, but I wasn't born yet, so it's hard to see how my parents could have thrice defied me. This scar is an obvious candidate for the mark.
Harry touched his forehead.
Then there's the power the Dark Lord knows not, which probably refers to my scientific background.
No,
said Severus. Harry looked at the potions master in surprise. Severus's eyes were closed. His face tightened in concentration.
The Dark Lord could obtain that power by studying the same books as you, Potter. But the prophecy did not say, power the Dark Lord has not, nor even power the Dark Lord cannot have. She spoke of power the Dark Lord knows not. It will be something stranger to him than Muggle artifacts, something perhaps that he cannot comprehend at all, even having seen it.
Science is not a bag of technological tricks, Harry said. It's not just the Muggle version of a wand. It's not even knowledge, like memorizing the periodic table. It's a different way of thinking.
Perhaps,
the potions master murmured, but his voice was skeptical.
It is hazardous, Albus said, to read too far into a prophecy, even if you've heard it yourself. They are things of exceeding frustration.
So I see,
Harry said. His hand rose up, rubbed the scar on his forehead.
But, okay, if this is really all we know... look, I'll just put it bluntly. How do you... know that the Dark Lord actually survived?
What?
She cried. Albus just sighed and leaned back in the vast headmaster's chair.
Well, Harry said, imagine how this prophecy sounded back when it was made. You know who learns the prophecy, and it sounds like I'm destined to grow up and overthrow him. That the two of us are meant to have a final battle where either of us must destroy all but a remnant of the other. So, you know who attacks Godric's Hollow and immediately gets vanquished, leaving behind some remnant which may, or may not be his disembodied soul. Maybe the Death Eaters are his remnant, or the Dark Mark. This prophecy could already be fulfilled, is what I'm saying. Don't get me wrong, I do realize that my interpretation sounds stretched. Trelawney's phrasing doesn't seem natural for describing only the events that historically happened on October 31st, 1981. Attacking a baby and having the spell bounce off isn't something you'd normally call the power to vanquish. But if you think of the prophecy as being about several possible futures, only one of which was actually realized on Halloween, then the prophecy could already be complete.
But,
Minerva blurted,
but the raid on Izkibian.
If the Dark Lord survived, then sure, he's the most likely suspect for the Azkaban breakout,
Harry said reasonably.
You could even say that the Azkaban breakout is Bayesian evidence for the Dark Lord surviving, because an Azkaban breakout is more